From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 7th day of September 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. He's in Newmarket, Indiana. And Harry Cooney will join us to take a look at the agricultural energy markets. In agricultural news, Senate Democrats believe they've the votes to pass prior to the next recess the small business legislation the body has been considering, but it is unclear if the bill will include an extension of the biodiesel tax incentive program. And Iowa Farm Bureau is now on board with the thinking of House Ag Committee Chair Colin Peterson and will ask Congress to eliminate direct payments in exchange for improved risk management tools. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories shortly. And don't forget, in just a few minutes, meteorologist Don Day will join us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Taking a look at the numbers as they settled up on this Tuesday afternoon at the CME Group in Chicago. September wheat at 7.02 and a half for the soft red, down 5 3/4. December at 7.35 1/4, 6 cents lower. And next year's July, 7.28 3/4, down 3/4. The lead option in Kansas City for the hard red winter wheat at $7.38 3/4 today, down 4 3/4 from the corn pit back in Chicago in the CME Group. 4.51 1/2, the settlement price, 1 3/4 higher. December at 4.66 1/4, up 1 3/4. March corn at 4.79 3/4, 2 cents higher. May at 4.84 1/4, up 1 3/4. July at 4.88 1/2 higher. And next year's December for 2011 at $4.50 1/4 a bushel, down 7 1/4. September soybean futures today at 10.43 3/4, up 14 cents. November at 10.52, up 17. January 10.61 1/2, up 17 3/4. And the March soybeans at 10.66 3/4, up 17 3/4. Meal at 308.70, up 50. Oil at 41.26, up 94 on the afternoon. Mercantile exchange numbers, October feeders at 96.35 settlement price, $2.10 lower. December there at 98.70, down a buck 95. September feeders at 111.92 1/2, down 225. October at 112.42 1/2, down 265 in the feeder cattle. And the October lean hog futures today at $75.60 for 100 pounds, down $1.60. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. October crude oil futures, $73.81 a barrel, down 79 cents. Ethanol at $1.90 1/10, a penny and 7 tenths higher on the day. October natural gas at $3.86 1/10, that's down 7.5 cents. The heating oil up a penny, even at $2.06 8/10 a cent, and the gold futures for the day at $1,257.30 a settlement price, up $8.10. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now stands at 10,359. That's just about 89 points lower, and the dollar at 82.81 is up 0.76. The CRB index on the afternoon at 273.81 is up 1.04 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for the immediate area this afternoon. The National Weather Service says mostly sunny skies, a high near 81 degrees, breezy, a west wind around 21 miles an hour. That'll gust up to as high as 31 this afternoon. Tonight, clear skies again, a low of 51 degrees, west-northwest winds between 5 and 13 with gusts up to 17. And then tomorrow, sunny skies, a high near 78, north-northwest winds between 5 and 8 miles an hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, a low around 52, northeast winds between 3 and 5. And Thursday should be partly sunny, a high near 77 degrees on Thursday. East-southeast winds between 5 and 7. Thursday night, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the area. Mostly cloudy, a low around 59 degrees. The extended forecast says Friday will have a 50% chance of showers, mostly cloudy, a high near 78, the low just about 63. Saturday, a chance of thunderstorms and showers, mostly cloudy, a high of 83. And Saturday night, partly cloudy, a low around 61 degrees. More on the ag weather when we get to the bottom of the hour.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. Online with us today is Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Why, good afternoon, Todd.
Let's talk about what's been happening in the marketplace after the Labor Day weekend. I'm mostly interested in what's been happening in the corn pit, where the December contract was down 7.25 cents. Those back months for the 2011 contract and 2012 is all a bit lower. What's the difference and what's happening?
Well, I think, number one, we've been looking at mainly production in the southern part of the U.S. Has been disappointing as we start out here. We're starting to get a few yields from up north, number one, that tell us that, we're going to have some better corn in places than some of our early yields, but still, all in all, why the numbers aren't quite adding up to what the government had to start with there. So the early this morning, we saw the funds sell about 7,000 contracts of corn, taking some profits early towards the end of the, coming into the report with maybe having bought more than they thought they needed on Friday. And then later in the morning, we saw them turn around and buy 10,000 and left them buyers about 3,000 contracts on the day first, Todd. We continue to see that they want to have ownership of the corn. Now, the real strength come in the beans when we saw the announcement of all the bean oil sales this morning and the good shipments for the last week. Mm. And, of course, then there was the tic-tac-toe of who's in charge over in Russia and whether the embargo is going to be held in place, as to whether they can ship wheat out or not. Putin and, I can't say his name, the other guy, basically are deciding, Mikhail, they're deciding who's in charge and how long it's going to last, and some say it's going to end sooner than later, and others say it'll last longer here, but that was where the big sell-off come in the wheat for last evening.
Okay, and so we had the bean market rallying on the news that there were some oil sales. Do we know where they went?
China bought the majority of it. There was some unknown and some to Chile also, so it was a sizable sale. The main thing about that is good, that it shows that we're competitive with the South American oil at this point in time, Todd.
Mm-hmm. And what are producers telling you about their crops? Did they get in the field over the weekend and harvest
months? Very, very active harvest weekend over here. Our bean yields are seeming to hold up in the somewhat close to the $50 to $55 bushel yields pretty much over here. We're hearing, though, that some of the later beans, rather than the earlier beans, as far as over here at one customer who has insurance says, I don't know, I might have a claim. I've got pods that should hold three beans, and there's only two and a very small bid in there, and they're wilting and they're green. So, we have some problems. A rain later this week would really help some of the later beans.
And with the corn, what are they seeing?
Can highly variable be a good thing to say? I think we've heard yields from 130 to 230 from over the weekend.
Okay, and then as you look forward through the month of September, can the marketplace continue to hold corn in the 450 range and above?
I think, the big thing is going to come on what the government says on Friday. Mm-hmm. Number one, and to say what percentage they actually did the weight of the ears and the testing that way to see if they'll believe them if they don't drop that number. And if they drop the number below or down towards the 160 level, I think we'll hang in there pretty easily, Todd.
What do you think the number is or should be?
What do I think it should be? I think I told Dave 162 before, and I think probably the 161, 162 is where the government's going to probably come in on this.
You think they'll come in that low? And if they don't and they surprise the market and come in with a 164 or above?
I think it's going to be then in the commentary on how they say they arrived at the number and where they held some stuff up. But I don't think the trade is not trading to 164 to 165 at this point in time.
Have you been following the livestock much? The numbers were all in the red today.
The numbers were all in the red. We sold off drastically there. I think that you know, probably some of the meat consumption during the very hot weather, you know, was way down, and I think that had leaned on the market a little bit there.
Anything else to add before I let you go for the afternoon?
No, I think, you know, that it, we're looking here, hoping for a little rain to finish filling out those beans, but very varied yields in the corn so far.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. That happens each and every Tuesday afternoon. If you can, please do visit our website. The address is WILLAG.org. There you'll find all of our agricultural programming from the pre-opening to the closing market reports and everything in between, including our Commodity Week program, which airs on Saturday. It's our look back at what happened in the world. It's all at WILLAG.org. You can download any of our programs anytime you'd like for free in their entirety and even sign up to have them delivered to your computer automatically as a podcast. It's all at WILLAG.org. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our free weekend newsletter, too. That's over on the right-hand side of the page. And if you go into that newsletter and you're already subscribed to it, you can manage your subscription. If you should happen to do that before Friday of this week and give us your cell phone number on Friday morning when the production numbers come out from the United States Department of Agriculture, you will receive a text. We don't send many of them. They almost always come on USDA report days. That's only a few months or a few times in a year. But we will send you a text with those numbers not long after they're released at 7:30 a.m. Central Time. It's all at WILLAG.org over on the right-hand side of the page. You can subscribe to our weekend newsletter, but more importantly, if you've already subscribed, manage it and give us your cell phone number. Now here's Dave with the Ag News for the day.
In agricultural news, Senate Democratic leadership say they have garnered enough votes to pass the small business measures that chamber was considering before the long summer recess. Unknown, though, is whether the final Senate bill will include an extension for the lapsed biodiesel incentive program. If not, language to do that, plus another one-year extension for the biodiesel program and for the ethanol blender credit program, which expires at the end of this year, will likely be part of a post-election lame duck session measure. But some sources are now saying they do not rule out that Congress may put the matter off until early into the next Congress in 2011. Pilgrim's Pride Corporation resumed exporting chicken to Russia over the weekend. Pilgrim's is the second largest U.S. chicken processor behind Tyson Foods. In a statement, Pilgrim's chief executive Don Jackson said demand from Russia was strong and that prices have strengthened. Rival poultry producer Samuelson Farms resumed its exports to Russia last month. The first known U.S. outbreak linked to a rare strain of E. coli in ground beef is prompting a fresh look at tougher regulations to protect the nation's meat supply. Cargill recalled about 8,500 pounds of ground beef on Saturday, and regulators warned consumers to throw out frozen meat purchased at BJ's wholesale clubs in 8 eastern states. The federal government currently requires meat plants to test for the strain of E. coli 0157H7, which causes an estimated 70,000 illnesses a year. But they don't have to test for 6 other less common strains of E. coli, including the 026 version that sickened those involved in the Cargill recall. In a resolution to Congress, the Iowa Farm Bureau voted to defend most programs but proposed eliminating direct payments in exchange for improved risk management tools. The group's 2-day policy meeting ended with members backing a resolution that the farm bill should provide a dependable, fiscally responsible safety net for farmers, but the group took the major step of proposing the elimination of the $5.2 billion direct payment program. Further, the group's policy stated that the risk management program needs to be better coordinated to avoid gaps and reduce redundancy. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report and Commodity Week. Both programs you can hear anytime you'd like off our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. If you can't get to the website or hear us on the radio, how about listening to our voicemail? It's just a telephone dial away at 217-333-3434. Now up next, you know the National Safety Council is always reminding farmers and ranchers to take care during the harvest season. I'll have more on one of the nation's most dangerous jobs and why farmers might just take an afternoon nap. Those of us that work a regular job expect a coffee break in the morning and the afternoon. There's a good reason why. Research shows it makes us more productive and more alert. Well, that same research can be applied to farmers and farm workers, says University of Illinois Extension Farm Safety Specialist Bob Aharon.
Yeah, it's important. Research shows us that every 2 to 2.5 hours of continuous work, even if that's operating a combine or tractor, we should stop for 10 or 15 minutes to take a break. What that does is it relieves us of the stress and focus of what we're doing, even if it might be kind of monotonous at times. And it makes when we go back, we're more mentally alert, less mentally fatigued, and much less likely to make a mistake and results in injuries. And our data shows that we have big peaks in injuries at mid-morning and mid to late afternoon after people have been working continuous hours and not stopping for any, you know, for a little break.
Aharon says much of the time it's important for others around the farm to remind workers to take a little break and to shut down the machinery. A little mid-morning snack, a little afternoon nap, that might be just a good thing.
At least a snack would be good. A nap would be nice. I know a lot of farmers, that might be challenging for them. But even if they went and ate lunch and slept for 15 or 20 minutes, it amazingly increases our alertness and dramatically decreases having an accident. If we have an accident, it's, you know, an average accident, and our estimate cost us about $25,000 to $30,000 in medical costs, downtime, lost productivity, those sorts of things. And if it's a fatality, it goes up to over $1 million. You look at lost productivity and those sorts of issues, as well as the direct cost of the death itself. And so it's important in managing risk that we understand how to manage ourselves to minimize those risks.
The message is clear and simple for the harvest season. Operator downtime pays because there are fewer errors, injuries, and even deaths when a body is well rested. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason, taking a look now at what's been happening in the world of agricultural energies on this Tuesday afternoon. With us is Harry Cooney of GrowMark in Bloomington, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Harry.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Lots of interesting things to talk about this afternoon. Let's start with the top of the news. There has been an explosion at a refinery in Mexico. What can you tell me about it?
Well, yes. Around mid-morning, a refinery down there had an explosion. It may not have been a fire. It may have just been an explosion. And it's still a little unclear as to really whether it hit one of their actual producing units or if it was more in just a storage area. One report says maybe a storage area, and some others here say that it really hit some of their distillation units. And it appears that if that is the case, this is one of the larger refining. It's like the third largest refinery in Mexico. Mexico already imports some gasoline, and they may have to significantly increase the imports of gasoline into their country if this here really did hit a part of the actual producing part of the refinery. So it appears from the market standpoint that maybe it did actually hit part of the producing. It was their most sophisticated refinery also in Mexico. So, again, details are a little sketchy coming out of it, but it's like a 235,000-barrel-a-day refinery, so a fairly good-sized refinery. Mid-morning, the gasoline and diesel fuel markets bottomed out around 10 o'clock, about when this occurred. Ever since then, it rallied up, and actually, the gasoline and diesel fuel markets actually closed higher today, up a couple cents, even though the crude oil market did still close lower, and that would be indicative of a refinery problem. The products maybe tighten a little bit, so their markets go up, whereas the crude is not going to be needed as much now if the refinery is down, and so the crude still closes lower. So we'll get more details on that in coming days.
Should that refinery explosion actually have an impact on the marketplace, and they need to import gasoline and diesel fuel, where are the most likely import sources? Will it come across the border from the United States or be imported from somewhere else?
Well, a lot of them would come probably from the Gulf Coast of the United States, and so that's probably the main source, but obviously it could probably come from other regions also. Just depends on how the pricing would be delivered in to their import terminals. But I would think a lot of it would come from the U.S. Gulf Coast.
I know you watch the charts. There are some interesting patterns you've been taking and making attention of?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of them is over in the stock market. The stock market's had a big impact on the energy markets. Like we've talked about, that if the stock market's going up, the economy may be improving, and if the economy's improving, oil demand improving. The stock market is kind of caught in a wide trading range here between about 10,000 and about 10,800. Breaking out of that pattern will probably be important. There are some suggestions it could break down, and if that's the case, then it takes us into a big slump. However, so far, even though there's been a lot of news reports of this pending drop coming in September and October, so far it's been holding up quite well. And thus, if the stock market goes down, then that probably drags energies down. There is a large seasonal tendency for the oil markets to drop eventually into mid to late fall, into that normal historically seasonally low time period of price, down from about Thanksgiving all the way out into January and February. And that's still the time period that we're kind of zeroing in on to start doing a contracting for 2011 needs. We'll look at the contracting period there from about Thanksgiving to Valentine's Day as the time to start locking in some. So for any producers or end users that are interested in locking some in, we're not really doing much at this time. We're more of looking at that time there around Thanksgiving to Valentine's Day.
And what would you say you might see in the marketplace that would tell you that things are turning sharply lower?
Well, I think the stock market action will be the big thing. Stock market action was probably very key.
Okay, thanks so much.
Real good, Todd.
Harry Cooney is with GrowMark in Bloomington, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. Stay with us if you can. I'll be back in just a couple minutes when we'll talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, about the agricultural weather forecast right here on this radio station.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
It's National Napoleon Day. It's also St. Regina Day, patron of shepherdesses. On this day in agricultural history in 1822, a treadmill was completed to grind corn at the New York City prison. It employed the labor of 8 to 16 inmates at a time. They would walk on what looked like a very wide 5-foot in diameter paddle wheel. Prisoners held onto a bar and climbed the paddle boards like endlessly walking on stairs. The contraption could grind up to 50 bushels of corn a day. In 1840, Luther Cromwell was born. An American inventor, he designed a machine to make square-bottomed grocery bags. Those bags are still in service today. In 1912, David Packard was born. He, along with William Hewlett, founded the Hewlett-Packard Company. Before they became famous for computers and printers, some of their early inventions included an automatic urinal flusher and a weight loss shock machine. And in 1948, the first rubberized asphalt road surface in the U.S. was applied to a mile-long stretch of Exchange Street in Akron, Ohio. The paving mixture contained as much as 11 pounds of crumbled synthetic rubber per ton of asphalt. It was thought the rubber would make the pavement more durable and safer in extreme weather, but that was not the case. And by 1959, rubber was no longer used as an asphalt additive. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason on the phone line with us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Good afternoon to you, Don.
Good afternoon, Todd.
How did the Midwest fare over the long weekend, and did we get much rainfall in any place?
Well, we did in some spots. It was one of those situations where the folks that probably didn't need as much rain as areas that needed got the rain, and the areas that needed the rain didn't do very well, as the eastern areas, the Corn Belt, still dry.
And then if you look forward, what do you see in the forecast for Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska?
Well, one thing we're going to have to watch is the tropical activity that's now moving into Texas, because the trajectory of that subtropical moisture is going to go north, northeast, out of Texas, through Oklahoma, into Kansas, then will likely impact Missouri, eastern Nebraska, Iowa, and portions of Illinois with an increased chance of shower and thunderstorm activity. And anytime you throw some tropical air into the equation, well, you can end up with some pretty good rains. And that is something that over the next several days we're going to have to watch. I think some of this moisture might eventually get into Indiana, Ohio, but it'll be Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, and southeast Nebraska, and southern Iowa that could see some heavier rain.
And then take a look around the rest of the planet, including the Southwest and the West and the Great Plains states, for winter wheat seeding, and tell me what kind of conditions they will have.
Well, it looks pretty dry in the far western areas of where they want to be planting the winter wheat, whether it's in Colorado or western or southwest Kansas, maybe some areas of the Oklahoma and Texas panhandles, and western Nebraska. Precipitation, it'll be spotty. Soil moisture is a little bit low in those areas. It's been dry recently. Could use some moisture to help out with some of the seeding. At the same time, the weather won't get in the way for planting, as it looks like a relatively quiet weather pattern out there.
How are subsoil moisture levels set up, and how did they make it through the winter months in Argentina and Brazil?
Well, if we were to go down south and take a look at South America, we see that the best soil moisture profiles are in Argentina. Those areas are the most moist. Those areas likely have the situation best in hand to get the season started. There are many areas of Brazil, especially some of the central and western areas, where soil moisture is a little bit below normal right now. And they'll be heading into at least the start of the spring season a little bit dry.
Anything else we need to check up on before I let you go for the day?
Still a little stormy and a little wet over in Asia and many areas of China.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Don Days with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural program. Agricultural. Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
The following production is an encore presentation of The Farming World from April of this year.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
This is The Farming World, news and interviews from the land grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Roger Johnson. He's the president of the National Farmers Union, better known, of course, as the NFU. It's a farmer organization founded more than 100 years ago and concerned from its beginnings with the stability and income of the farm. In 2009, Mr. Johnson was elected president of the NFU. Prior to that, and leading the family farm organization, Johnson was a third-generation family farmer from Turtle Lake, North Dakota, and he served as North Dakota's agriculture commissioner, a position he was first elected to in 1996. Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for joining us from your Washington, D.C. office today.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Now, tell me a little bit about your history with the NFU and with state politics in North Dakota, please.
Sure. Well, I was born on a farm in North Dakota that was actually homesteaded by my grandfather over 100 years ago, and grew up there, went off to the land grant institution, NDSU, got a degree in ag economics, came back and farmed, and then eventually, during that whole time that I was farming, I actually grew up in the Farmers Union organization. North Dakota's got a very strong state farmers union organization. So I was involved in it. I was involved in the county organization. I was the chair of the board of the local Farmers Union Oil Company, otherwise known as Senex to most folks around the country. And then eventually I was elected ag commissioner in 1996 and served in that capacity for a dozen years. And then just over a year ago, was elected as National Farmers Union president. That's kind of my short version of my history. I've been involved in the organization all my life.
You've been so active in politics. Are you active on the farm, or are you a farm owner?
Well, right now, my brother is doing the farming. I do it on shares, so officially, I guess I'm still a farmer, but practically speaking, I'm not out there very much anymore.
We understand. So you're on a 50-50 or 60-40? Or
yeah, it's a long ways from Washington, D.C. to the farm in Turtle Lake, North Dakota.
I bet it is. They're two different worlds, I suppose,
yes,
are they not?
They are. Yes. They are, very much so.
What is it that NFU is actively involved in seeking out in Washington, D.C. at this point?
Well, you know, there are a number of things. We are an organization that prides ourselves in supporting family farmers and ranchers around the country. Our basic strength, our core strength, is kind of in the Great Plains. We're first founded in Texas and moved up through the Great Plains and then kind of spread in both directions from there over the years. We are very active in paying attention to what the farm bill is looking like. We just passed a farm bill. We're in the early stages of implementation right now. The permanent disaster program, otherwise known as the SURE program, is one of the big priorities that Farmers Union had in the last farm bill, and we're just seeing that begin to be implemented now. Crop insurance is of substantial importance to us. It is probably the single most important risk management tool, safety net that we have in the farm program
right now for farmers in the country. So we're going to make sure that that remains effective and part of the Farm Bill. And, of course, we're starting hearings shortly on the next Farm Bill, as Chairman Peterson has made those announcements. We've been very actively involved in energy and climate issues. Climate, or energy in particular, is one of those things where we've long supported ethanol as an example, renewable forms of energy and fuel, wind energy. We're big supporters of that and have a number of initiatives underway to promote wind energy. We want to make sure that as the Senate now begins to consider this question of whether it's going to be just an energy-only bill or a climate and energy bill, that we're well positioned to make sure that the kinds of incentives that are important for the ethanol industry, the biodiesel industry, the wind industry, as well as biomass production, that those incentives are really put in place and so that they become a part of the bill. Those are, I'd say, farm bill and energy kinds of issues are a real important part of what we've been working on. Of course, one of the things in front of Congress right now is the question of financial market reform. And most people understand that this economic crisis, this great recession that we are in the early stages of emerging from right now, was really caused by the lack of regulation that happened over the years as Congress and previous administrations just gradually pulled down all the different kinds of regulatory requirements that financial institutions had to pay attention to, and basically turned this into something which some have described as a glorified gambling casino with our money, with your money and my money. And as a result, we saw the economy collapse, not only in our country, but around the world. And so there's a very concerted effort now that is underway in the Senate. The House has already passed a bill to look at what's the right way to regulate this industry, and in particular to get a handle on these derivatives and swaps and these financial instruments that are unregulated and are sort of a mechanism that lots of folks in the finance industry have been using to make piles and piles of money at your and my expense.
Mr. Johnson, so that our listeners, farmer and consumer alike, will understand a bit more about the NFU, I'm sure that you had a position on the health care debate.
Yes.
That took place. Which side of that debate was NFU on?
We were very supportive of health care reform and remain so. Our members set our policy, and for many years, we have been in favor of a single-payer universal care system, which is the same system that virtually every other major industrialized country in the world uses. And they, by the way, all provide care to all of their citizens at about half the cost that we provide care to the citizens in the U.S., short about 40, 45, 47 million Americans who don't get care covered under insurance. So we're very supportive of the legislation. We think, frankly, that it didn't go far enough, that it should have done more to control costs, and a public option really would have done that. But it's certainly a huge step in the right direction in trying to include a lot more folks and in getting rid of some of these, what I've long called immoral actions that insurance companies have been able to use by denying coverage to insureds based on pre-existing conditions and dropping policies just when folks most needed the coverage and those sorts of things. So they've been corrected in the bill, and it's certainly a huge step forward.
Thank you very much. That'll give the folks listening a bit of a foundation on which to to take a look at NFU. Now, let's go back to financial regulation. That one is just heating up in Washington, D.C. Is the NFU for or against more financial regulation in the marketplace?
We are very much for it. We think that what you have to do is you have to take these trades that, you know, it used to be that the financial industry was very significantly regulated, and for very good reason. I mean, most banks, if they have 10% equity, that's a pretty well-capitalized bank. If I or any of my neighbors only had 10% equity on our farm, we'd consider to be bankrupt. You need a lot more equity in farming than you do in banking. And the fact that banks get along with so little equity, that's their own money. That means 90% of the money that they handle is someone else's money. It's our money as depositors or as borrowers, that they need to be regulated as to what they can do with those dollars. And the purpose of the regulations historically have been to make sure that they didn't put those in very risky investments. And that's why for many, many years, banks were precluded from issuing insurance policies or getting into that business. They were precluded from going on the markets, the I can't think of the term right
derivative.
Now. The derivatives. They were precluded from doing those kinds of things because they were unregulated, and they were, by their very nature, much riskier investments. And so if they put their money there and they lost it, it would actually not just be their money, it would be our money that would be lost. And so over the years, many in the industry have argued successfully that the regulations ought to be relaxed, 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 until they were, for all practical purposes, non-existent. And banks then found themselves in the position of having enormous financial stakes in very, very risky financial instruments that were unregulated, and in large part, that was the reason that we saw the economy collapse. So we've got to get a handle on this and make sure that those investments that are made with our money, with your money and our money made by banks, are in fact put in very sound places, and that we regulate their ability to invest in highly speculative kinds of markets.
The farmers set the policy for NFU, is that correct?
Yes, our members, by the way we are organized, our members show up at our county conventions and they elect delegates to state conventions, and at the state conventions they elect delegates to national conventions, and then those delegates at our national convention are the ones that establish the policy.
Did they set financial policy the last time around?
Yes, actually our members did establish a policy on financial regulation. We did a number of special orders of business at our last convention, and that was one of them. I think we did six or seven. We did one on healthcare and on energy and the economy, and financial regulation was one of those, trade was another, and so forth. So yes, our members did establish a policy relative to financial regulation and very specifically said that they wanted there to be more oversight over these financial markets.
Today we're talking with Roger Johnson. He is the president of the National Farmers Union. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Land Grant right here in Urbana-Champaign, the University of Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. We'll return in a moment.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to Cooley at admworld.com.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the Associated Press's Economic Stress Index shows that economic stress declined month to month in July in about 54% of the nation's 3,141 counties and in 24 of the 50 states. The AP's index calculates a score for each county and state from 1 to 100 based on unemployment, foreclosure, and bankruptcy rates. A higher score indicates more economic stress. Under a rough rule of thumb, a county is considered stressed when its score exceeds 11. The AP's index found the average county's stress score in July was 10.5, unchanged from the previous month. Burger King is introducing 9 new breakfast items, including blueberry biscuits and pancake platters, to broaden its breakfast menu. The move aims to grab some of McDonald's breakfast business. Chief Marketing Officer Mark Caput says many people don't know that Burger King has breakfast, so that's why the company is making the big push. Last week, the nation's number 2 hamburger chain said it was selling itself to private equity firm 3G Capital in a deal valued at $3.26 billion. And sales of passenger cars in China, the world's biggest market, rose 18% in August from a year earlier. Sales of all vehicles rose nearly 56% in August from a year earlier to 1.21 million vehicles. That contrasted with a 5% decline in August sales in the U.S. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with Roger Johnson, the president of the National Farmers Union, better known as the NFU. When we left, he last told us that the organization's policies were set by the farmers from the ground up. We were talking about financial regulation and financial policy. Mr. Johnson, what's happening on the Hill at this point?
The bill that is being considered right now in Congress is one that basically what it says at its heart is these derivatives, these which are financial instruments that are one step or two steps or three steps removed from the basic financial transaction, that these derivatives have to be transparent. One of the things that you learn in economics is that markets work best when the information that is used by buyers and sellers is available to everybody. That's a way of saying that the information is very transparent. And so one of the basic requirements that is a part of this re-regulation of financial markets is to make sure that that information is transparent. The way you do that is you have these derivatives become, to the degree that they are standard kinds of instruments, you have them cleared over exchanges so that everyone can see what they were sold for, what they were bought for, who the buyers and sellers were. And when everybody knows that, there is more information available to the rest of us in the marketplace, and we can all better judge as to whether these trades are appropriate, whether they are risky, the degree of risk that's associated with them, et cetera. And so fundamentally, that's the issue that Congress is grappling with. Should these derivatives be traded in full view of the public, just like a lot of the other markets are, the Chicago Board of Trade, where people know what wheat trades for, what corn trades for, what soybeans, what oil trades for, all those things because they're on established markets. Derivatives of those entities and of other financial products should also be traded in a similar fashion so everyone can see, and then you have a much more efficiently operating market and one that's not likely to be so surprised by having lots of folks heavily invested in extraordinarily highly speculative positions.
So regulation mostly involves the ability to standardize the derivative such that people would be able to understand what it is and to put it on an exchange. I have a secondary question that's related to that, because you did bring up the exchanges and the Chicago Board of Trade, or the CME group at this point. I'm wondering whether your farmer members are for or against more regulation there in terms of the index funds and the size of positions that they can take. And that might be extended to all exchanges and include, for instance, crude oil.
Sure. We, as I said before, Todd, we very much are in favor of markets that operate more efficiently and that are more transparent. And to the degree that you've got these transactions that are happening out of the public view, that's not a good thing. It's not a way for markets to behave more efficiently, and it is the principal reason that we saw such a major crash in the economy, according to lots of economists. Now, not everyone believes that, but lots of folks really do. And so, yes, we think that, and as a matter of course, for many, many years, the IRS, to make a determination as to whether you or I were hedging a product or speculating in a marketplace, those are two very different things. And there were limits placed on the number of positions that we could take, the number of contracts that we could enter, either on the buy side or on the sell side. And there's very good reason to have those limits. It is so that you can avoid an entity or a couple of entities essentially cornering the market, going in and buying up so much of the market that you drive the market price higher, or selling so much that you force the market price down just by your own actions as an individual company or entity. That's why you have, as a matter of history, that's why you have limits that are imposed on these different entities and the amount that they can go into these marketplaces. The CME is a perfect example, where it's a very, very thinly traded market, especially for things like milk and dairy products. And as a consequence, there are, well, in fact, that's one of the things that the USDA and the Department of Justice right now are very closely looking at with respect to the dairy industry and potential economic concentration in that industry, and whether there's undue ability to arbitrarily influence that marketplace to the detriment of the farmers and, in fact, to the detriment of the consumers. So that whole area is something that Congress is looking at right now to try and figure out, okay, what's the proper level of oversight or regulation that should be applied here, so that we don't find ourselves in the kind of pickle that we found ourselves in about a year and a half or 2 years ago.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Happy to do so.
Roger Johnson is the president of the NFU, the National Farmers Union. He talked to us from his Washington, D.C. office. You've been listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois. I'm UofI Extension's Todd Gleason.